It's delightful to be here today with Gabe and Glenn. This is the first time these two guys have met. I have all these wonderful friends in my corner, and it's wonderful to introduce them to each other. So, and Glenn and Gabe have been talking offline a little bit about some of their ideas, and I'm going to let Gabe get started here, and then we'll bring Glenn in and find out what he's been thinking.
Thank you, Karen. And thank you, Glenn, for coming on and doing it. I am excited, and I appreciate you taking the time. I guess to kind of help me figure out where to start exactly, if you could just give me an idea of what drew you into this conversation, what jumped out at you, what stood out about what I was doing that gave you enough pause to say like that you were willing to come on and have a conversation. What was it that tickled your intuition and got you thinking about what I was doing?
Okay, so I'm probably coming from a different direction than you're used to. So I'll give you a little background. Is that for a few years as an electronics engineer, I had the great opportunity to work for a couple of different contract engineering houses that specialized in medical device design development. And the pattern of the flow was that doctors, usually specialists, they would come up through their practice with some idea like, well, if we just had a device or a mechanism or something that could do this, then we could do that, and we'd have a new procedure. We can market and help people and make some money at the same time. So they would come in, talk to the partners of the firm, present their ideas, and then there'd be, back and forth about, well, what can you do? How much is going to cost, of course. And if they wanted to go ahead with the project, then the partners, managers of the firm would pull together a team of engineers with different specialties related to whatever the product would be. So if a device needed an electronics internal, whether it's sensing, user interface, little computer embedded, that was a little my niche. And coming from physics into engineering, it gives you a different approach, which is really handy when you're doing that startup kind of initial 0 to 1 transition kind of thinking, because you're trained to take a problem down to first principles and then build a solution back up. So then there would be a meeting between the people who are prospects and some of us engineers, and we ask them questions and we'd grill them. And so that's about what I'm going to do to you.
Perfect.
I would say, imagine you've got your ideas. I've gone through all your diagrams, and you've got this, and you've got some investors, and you want to build it. And you're going to come in, and you're going to tell me, and that's the kind of questions I'm intrigued at, and why I'm pulled in, because I see in what you're describing a pattern that I've seen over and over again with other people. And I'm curious about it, that you're all on to something. And I was thinking, Richard Watson, I think you've talked to him, but
Yes.
he's in a sense, he's talking about the same patterns, but he uses music and harmonies to create his model. Balazs has talked about levels. And even Harish is, I'm listening to him talk, and I'm sensing buried in there is this notion of levels, that if you're going to interact with the environment, it has to, there has to be levels below, levels above. There has to be upward and downward causality. There has to be interactions between a lot of different factions. And I see that in your diagram. You're pulling right and left and top and down. And I'm thinking, okay, you're seeing what other people are seeing, that there has to be some flow. I don't know. I'm lacking words here. But so that's what got me pulled in. I say, oh yeah, someone else is seeing it. And so I'm curious there. My interest is in building things. And I'm saying, well, how do I build what you guys are describing? you in particular. And so that's the kind of approach that I take. And I've sort of found that when you ask yourself, how am I going to build this? You start asking completely different questions and things happen. And so that's where I'm coming from. I'm interested in origins of life questions. How do you create life? How does life grow? How does, as Perry Marshall would say, where does new code come from? How does a entity gain consciousness? How does it access the outside world and then create new patterns and grow? And I see in what you're describing is you're trying to grasp at a mechanism that will give you that functionality. So correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I'm picking up on.
No, that's exactly right. And part of why this conversation is so exciting and timely for me is that I'm getting to that space where I feel like I have enough where I can start to ask that question, how do I make this thing? Yeah. And then talking with Ryan, who's the computer programmer, and his insight, and just trying to find people like yourself who have that background and understanding of how to build things. Because I've always built things, and generally it's more hardware, mechanism, steel, wood, leather, that sort of thing.
It's all the same.
That I've worked with, and it's kind of you're kind of in between the space of me and Ryan, because he's in the programming side, and I'm very much in the hardware side of thinking, at least in my past experiences. And so you're sort of in the middle. So I'm just excited to talk to you about that. And then as far as the way I've come at it, I think, and I've mentioned it before, I think in images and I think in shapes and I think in connections. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I was trying to do initially, some almost 14 years ago when I started now, is to understand the pattern at the bottom of physics. I started with physics and just an interest, just a layman's general interest in how things worked. And I was very much committed to understanding the science. And I think part of what led me down this path is I generally have a hard time with mathematics in the sense of understanding the symbols and being able to build the visuals, because I was one of those kids who could, you'd give them a bunch of equations and you tell them how to use the equations. And I'm like, I can't do this because I need to know how the equations work in order to operate them, because I couldn't, for whatever reason, I've never been able to just take something like an equation and understand what to plug in those spaces. Because if I don't know how it works, I don't understand how the things get plugged in. And so I've come at this whole thing while still honoring the people that come before me and have made the discoveries that they have. I've come at it in an entirely different direction, trying to visualize and understand the relationships geometrically. And as we get into it, that's something I hope to communicate. But no, I think you're the perfect guy to talk to, exactly. And feel free to grill me, because that's what I need at this stage. I need to know if it's going to work, and I need to know if it's worthwhile.
Well, my first thought was only 14 years.
Yeah, right.
So I started in physics when I was 15 in high school, took my first physics class, and I'm 72 now, and I've been with it all that time. And I'm at the point now, I'm figuring if I can just understand a little piece of it, maybe I'm okay.
Yeah. Well, that's another reason I was just hoping to glean wisdom from your experience, because again, I'm not educated formally in it. And so I've had to really, I try to listen to the experts and find the people who know better than I do in order to test the things that I'm doing. But that being said, I think, Karen, do I have share screen?
Oh, yes, I'll get it for you.
I think I'll kind of start with a very basic shape. Let me... Can y'all still hear me?
I can hear you, but I don't see anything except our original screen. There we go.
Okay.
Can y'all still hear me?
Yeah, we lost the screen though.
Oh, okay. Let me. Can you hear me again?
Yeah, no problem hearing you.
Yeah, let me try that again. For whatever reason, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. All right. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is starting to sound like a cell phone commercial.
Okay. Yeah. And let me, all right, I'm gonna try to broadcast here. And let me know if I disappear again
But you've never disappeared. We just don't when it
or I
works.
guess you can't. Am I
There we
still
go.
there?
Yeah,
Okay.
you've got it now. Whoop, we just lost it. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. It's all right. I got the whiteboard. Okay. All right. Well, I have the whiteboard for this very occasion. So just to kind of start, the dichotomy that kind of formed in my mind was the relationship between time and space. Because the very early on in my naivety, I was thinking about time, space, energy, matter. And the thought that came to mind, and you'll have to bear with me because I promise the early stages sound stupid even to me, or foolish, or just childish. But I worked up from there. So if you'll just bear with me on this, but I the thought that came to mind was you have those four fundamental things that physicists would talk about: time, space, matter, energy. And I was like, I began to think, well, what if time and space are more fundamental and matter and energy are emergent aspects of the interaction of time and space? And you'll see in my model that the focus, the primary pattern is that of an outside and inside interacting in tension. And the tension between them is that creative space. And it's the thing where the molecules are, where the atoms are, where the subatomic particles are, where we are, is that space in between the outside and the inside. And so as I went on, I started to, let's see if this will work. I started to think about time in terms of a volume instead of just a line. And the arrow of time will come in eventually with the how these things interact, but just beginning with how this goes. And then I thought of space as a volume as well. And so I had my inside, which was time, and my outside, which was space, is how I thought about it. And part of the reason I was thinking that way was you think of time dilation in a gravitational field or under acceleration. The greater the gravitational field, the slower the clock ticks. And so I started to think in terms of, well, the slower the clock ticks referentially, relatively, means the second is longer. So time is increasing in a sense. So in my mind, as you move inward towards the gravitational well, the greater gravity, time increases. So that's why I put time as the inside and space as the outside, because I had that kind of general intuition. And again, this is all going to sound very elementary. So, but then I started for a long time, it took me forever, struggling with charge, like where charge came from, what was it? Because in my mind, the time was a pulling inward and the space was a pulling apart. And so you have the inward and the outward, the inside and the outside. And charge seemed to be in a space between, where the negative charge you can think of as a flowing out and the positive charge as a flowing in. And they worked together in that way. And I thought about, okay, moving into the four dimensions, and there's a whole background to this with, if you change the formula of force, Newton units, to mass times acceleration, if you consider mass and even charge in terms of a resistance to acceleration, and you invert acceleration to equal second squared per meter, then you have a dimensionless quality of force that is reminiscent of Newton's third law, which is equal and opposite reaction. So that it balances itself out. And I can get into that in detail in a minute.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we need to stop there for a second, because we've already got a lot.
Yeah.
We've got a lot here. So I mean, I don't know any of this stuff. So, but I have a question about that last thing that you said, because I think visually, so without seeing that formula and seeing how they balance, it's not going to make any sense to me. But just what you've said already, Glenn, do you have any comments about that general picture that he just drew about the outside and the inside being pulling, that time being the inside, and that it's pulling inward, and it would also relate to, I guess, the positive charge, which is flowing in. And then being the outside pulling apart would be the negative charge flowing out. Is that?
I didn't quite get to that part of it. So maybe if I could just cover that really quick. So the way the positive charge flowing out and negative charge flowing in, I might have said that backwards. So you have space out and time in, and that's just a property of the two. And then I was thinking about charge, and it's like, okay, well, when you think of the nucleon, when you think of the atom, the positive charge is internal and the negative charge is external. And that's the way they relate to each other. So the positive charge has to be inside, but it has a property of space, which is flowing out. And the negative charge, which is outside, has a property of time, which is flowing in. And so I thought about, well, if you twisted time into space, you would get that negative charge. And if you twisted space into time, you would get that positive charge, and they would be oriented accordingly with each other in terms of the layout of an atom. And then the reason that this worked is, for me, the map that came to mind is, if I associated, and there's a lot behind this, but if you'll just kind of humor me for a moment, I associated the neutrino with time and the antineutrino with space. And if you emit a W minus boson, you get, if you have a neutrino which emits a W minus boson, you get a positron, which is a positive. And in the same sense, if an antineutrino absorbs a W plus boson, you also get a positron. So there's this tension in that way. And then in the same sense, if you absorb a W minus, you get an electron. And if you emit a W plus from a neutrino, if a neutrino absorbs a W minus or emits a W plus, you get an electron. And this goes much further than that, but that's kind of the foundational idea and the pattern that came up. And then between the two charged particles, you have your photons. And this one is still more speculation than the rest of this, but I have the map here, the communication, because Z bosons communicate energy and momentum as well. And so I've tentatively put that in that space as communicating between the inside and the outside. But what you're getting is time and space and a twisting into each other to form charge, and then the communication between the two that holds things together. And that's the creative space in the middle. So hopefully that clarifies a little. There's more to it, as I said, but I would like to get your thoughts.
Well, it's quite unique compared to all my education in physics. So, but I'm coming back to your inside and outside in the space and time. You're grasping at relationships, and that in a sense is you're onto something. In quantum mechanics is non-local. So the whole notion of space and time kind of is gone in the quantum realm. They even propose stuff like backwards causality, that the future can influence the past. So trying to separate them is not something I would try and do.
Yeah, they're separate in a sense. So this gets deeper in. So this is really the very basic kind of shape of the thing. And so the idea, as we take it further, is...
Well, okay, so Gabe, okay. Just a second.
Yeah.
Give Glenn the opportunity to flesh out what he's saying here.
I'm speaking as a physicist, my next reaction is, well, the W bosons, that's quite a lot of energy. And so what you just described would be quite a bit of energy to come together to create that much matter interacting at one spot.
Okay. Yeah, I think.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, I mean, dumb question. Wouldn't that be what it would require for the universe to come into being? It's quite a lot of energy.
Well, if you think in the terms of virtual particles, they pop in as pairs. Mm-hmm. So you get a positron and an electron, or you get a neutrino and an antineutrino pair. And it requires a convergence, or whatever the term is, of energy in that point in space for those virtual particles to appear. And it's always in that pair. So that was another reason for the dichotomy. And I'm not, like, you can't look, and this is where it's hard to communicate, you can't look at that pattern as all existing at once. All it is a pattern of relationships between. So it's not that we have a neutrino and an antineutrino and a positron and an electron. It's just a placeholder for the relationship between them. So if that helps kind of clarify. So yeah, it's not that. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I've sort of said, oh, what's the Feynman diagrams? Can you describe it? It's Feynman diagrams, but I'm picking up on the inside and outside, and my experience is that's important, that okay. relationship. And I'm sensing you're picking up on that.
Yeah, no, that's primary for me because
Okay, so here I want to hear what Glenn has to say about the inside. I know you're excited.
Oh, it's okay.
Excited game.
No, feel free.
I know when he has something to say, so I just want to hear what Glenn has to say about the inside and the outside.
I will slow down, sorry.
Well, for my part, what I pick up on is the contrast between quantum and classical physics. That's the edge. That maybe classical physics is emergent, let's say, out of quantum mechanics. And there's that edge where they interact is where a lot of the magic happens. That's what I've picked up on. So I'm wondering if that's what
I need to clarify. You're saying that the classical is emergent out of the quantum. But what we've seen chronologically in terms of scientific discoveries is the knowledge of the quantum has come subsequent to the knowledge of the classical. So could you explain why you see the classical as being emergent out of the quantum?
Well, two different kinds of time. Who was it? Wolfgang, remember you talked to a long time ago?
Wolfgang Smith?
Yeah, he talked about two different kinds of time. There's a continuous kind of time, but then there's the experiential time, which translates from one event to the next event. And that's one of the contrasts, is in the quantum realm, time doesn't really mean much. Before and after, here and there, kind of lose their meaning. But to have definite sequence of this after that, then this follows, that's the classical notion of time. And I think Wolfgang Smith talked about those as being two separate things. There again, I think he's suggesting the same thing, levels of consciousness and things going on.
And that's
So this is very exciting because this makes me think about a conversation that Jordan Peterson and Russell Brand had recently. And Russell Brand, it makes this comment, and I think this is like so pertinent to this right here. It's like he all of a sudden gets it and he says, yes, he says, for now this, I'm gonna have to explain this after I give you the quote, but he says, yes, for a meme to land, for it to imprint, it can't merely sustain its own ongoing randomness and simultaneously narrativize in when with this the ongoing randomness cannot narrativize without some stopping point. And that's exactly what quantum mechanics is this there's no, it's just this continuous thing, there's no stopping point. And this is why so many physicists and scientists today will say there really is no reality. It's just all particles moving around, and we've discovered some way of seeing it, but we're not really seeing it. But what Russell Brand is saying is that for things to have identity, for them to exist at all, there has to be a stopping point. And that's what experiential time does, is it gives a moment for things to land. It has to land at some point. And that's what classical mechanics does, is it gives it a place to land. It develops that what Wolfram talks about as the slice of computational reducibility. And that's what experiential time gives us, is that slice of computational reducibility. Does that make sense?
No, that makes me think of listening to your past talks. Yes. Can you hear me? Am I cutting out? Oh, no.
Yes, you're.
Cut out briefly, but you're here again.
Okay. No, that's touching exactly on what I'm trying to do with the idea of a volume of time, as opposed to, it makes me think of the causal gap that you've talked about in the past. It's like what is that gap look like? And I think the linearity of time comes from the kind of the branching of possible futures, and the causal gap is that space in which the choice is made that chooses one of those branches and collapses that space, which brings it in a sense out of the volume of time into linear time. So it's that linear time exists in the space between that relationship between of charge, but the volume of time is the offsetting volume of space. It's the inside which we cannot see. It's the inside. It's like the outside we see, and in a sense, the outside we see our past. And we can look out and see our past. And at the same time, you're looking out and your future is also out there, but you see the past. And the inside of time, it's almost like it holds the volume of time holds all possible futures in these threads that come in. And you pull on one of those threads, and then it pulls it into the relationship between space and time. And you have that causal gap where things collapse and a decision is made, and that information is transferred to the next node. Is kind of just trying to grasp at what I'm trying to do.
I'm comfortable with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like that.
Okay. But that, oh,
But
sorry.
I've
Were you
thought
gonna?
about that often, that the only thing we can see is the past. That's all that's visible to us, is what's already happened.
Yeah.
That's the only thing we can see. And that is the outside. That's what we have access to. But the inside, the part we don't have access to, like the inside of when Glenn talks about a watch, I can manipulate the watch. I can, wind it up, and I can look at it, and I can tell what time it is, and I can measure things by the watch and everything. But I don't know what's going on inside of there. And that's exactly what the future is. It's the, all of the unknown, all of the chaotic possibilities of the unknown, but they're all on the inside of time. I can't see what's going on there. Yeah, I really like that.
Thank you. So, and then moving forward, I think it helps to, I think a good way to do it is you think of, are you familiar with the Clifford Torreses, Clifford Torrey?
Probably. You have to remind me.
So a three sphere, which is a hypersphere, I'm sure you know, can be broken down into two Clifford Torrey that equal Clifford Torrey that make up the hypersphere. Like you can map them, you can map those two Torreys exactly onto the hypersphere. So I think, and again, we can get into it at some point, but the way the SI units were retranslated based on that little equation I did, it gave me four-dimensional time and space. It was operating in four dimensions. So you have that four-dimensional hypersphere, and then you have those two tori, and they are, from what I understand, they are orthogonal. And this can be mapped in a finite way onto the 120 cell, which is a geometric shape. And to kind of simplify the idea, it's a 120 cell because it's made up of 120 dodecahedrons, which are the pentagon platonic solid. And there are two rings of 10, which was exciting to find because my system is a system of 10 inner units and outer units. So that was exciting. And so it's two rings of 10 that are orthogonal to each other. So you have your one ring and the other ring that interlink. And so, and then the way this maps is that one ring is the inner ring and the outer ring swells out to encase the inner ring. So there's this inside ring of 10 and outside ring of 10. And now between those two rings of 10 in the 120 cell are each five twisting rings, kind of like a hop vibration, a finite hop vibration. And each one has five. And if you look at my model, there are five, as you flow through it on the flower pattern, there are five coming in. So it's the five sensory aspects and the five motor aspects. So each of these rings, one is inside, one is out, has a set of rings that are twisting out and twisting in. And they form a version, essentially I have to find, hold on, let me grab my notes. I have the term for this. A discrete quantized hop vibration is the technical term. And so what you're getting there is your, I would say one ring is the inner aspect of the model and the other ring is the outer. And then to take it further down, unless you have any questions about that specific part of it.
Is this related to what Eric Weinstein is doing?
I don't know because I don't completely understand what he's doing. So if it is, I would absolutely love to see like where we met on that, but I don't have the chops.
Yeah, it's just one of those things in the back of my head that's the kind of thing he's talked about in the past.
Yeah, no. And then, and two, Penrose talks about that hop vibration as well. Mm-hmm. So it was also encouraging for me, the lowly autodidact running into these powerhouses of thinking and being like, oh, I'm at least I'm kind of in this same realm. So you have that discrete quantized hop vibration, and it breaks down, it can be broken down into 10 distinct 600 cells, which are icosahedrons, which are the triangles, the triangular kind of semi-spherical platonic solid, and they're duals. So a dual, and I'm sure you know, but I'll just explain this for anybody listening. A dual platonic solid is one where the center, the vertex of one matches the center of the other. And as you swell one or and shrink the other, they kind of move past each other in a very symmetric way. So they have a distinct relationship of how they're laid out. And you can see it much better visually if you look up platonic duals. And so the 120 cell, which is a discrete quantized hot vibration, breaks down into 10 600 cells, which can further be broken down to 20 tetrahedronic tori, or 20-30 tetrahedronic tori. So what that is, to simplify, is essentially like a little Klein bottle or a Möbius strip made of tetrahedrons, which is the four-faced pyramid, which is another platonic solid. So what you're getting there is another set of rings that twist, that are twisting. So it's that Klein action, that Möbius strip. You're able to move inside to outside without crossing any boundaries. So you have that shape built into this shape. And it was really cool to find, because I had, based on Harissa's work on twin primes, I started looking into it and I found a number line that maps directly onto this. And it being 30 tetrahedrons that make up these rings, and the relationship between a neutrino and an electron in twisting out, as I described it, the numbers on the line are exactly 30, and the number of these tetrahedrons are actually 30. And so each one of these rings maps out on this number line as a tetrahedron matching an individual number. And these twin prime numbers act as little points of stability where we find these particles, these neutrinos, electrons, positrons, and antineutrinos. And their relationship is fundamental, because if you move up to beta decay, you're starting to see beta negative. You have the, I think I'm going to make the, mix this up. You have the antineutrino electron and no, is that right? Well, you have the beta and positive and beta minus decay. You have these same neutrino, antineutrino, positron, electron interactions of emission. So it's all, and we can slowly work towards that, but I can show you with this number line that I've created and these twin primes how to move through that space. And that's what got me excited about the fourth programming language, because it deals with numbers and stacks. And the way you described it with the grammar, and I have this vocabulary, it's like, okay, I'm getting to a place where I feel like I can start to map this in a way that you could actually run a simulation. So I'm going to stop there because I'm getting excited again. So
before you start, Glenn, I want to ask one question of Gabe. So what you're coming to here, are you thinking that this is the fundamental structure of the universe, or is this just a model in your head or a picture of?
Well, that was, the more that lines up, the more I tentatively want to believe that that's what it is. I don't know. Honestly, for me, it's a map to understand. I mentioned my struggle with mathematics and understanding why the formulas did what they did, what they represented, how to use them. And so I'm coming at it building a shape that I can visualize and understand. So each one of these relationships, each one of these shapes, each one of these platonic solids, each one of these geometrical four-dimensional hyperspheres and Clifford tori, they all are associated with math, and I understand that. And so what I'm hoping is, if I can draw these relationships correctly, then eventually I'll have a model and the math will just plug in because I don't understand it. Like I'm not good at it. And then seeing these formulas start to fall into place, then perhaps I can, from the ground up, understand the mathematics, because I can't do it top down. I've tried, and it's a miserable slog for me. So in an effort to understand the mathematics, I've gone all the way to the floor and tried to climb my way back up, which was ambitious and likely somewhat foolish, but like that's just the how I had to do it. The joke I like to tell is, or not even a joke, it's an anecdote. It actually happened. My dad tried to teach me how to drive a standard, and he couldn't do it. I could not learn how to drive a standard transmission. And then one day I looked at a diagram of how a clutch worked, and the next day I drove standard without a problem. And so it's like, as soon as I understood the mechanism, I could operate the machine. But before that, my brain could not map it. I just couldn't map it. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
I'm sorry, I have to smile, because I ended up in grad school because I was really interested in classical mechanics. And I was intrigued by the idea that quantum mechanics might somehow be found within classical mechanics, because if you push the mathematical formalisms up through, you know, all the models of Poincaré sections and all that, you manifolds, fiber bundles, it starts to look a little bit like quantum mechanics. So yeah, I ended up at UC Santa Cruz and had my courses in all that. And even I know I touched on Clifford algebras at some point, but that's like 35 years ago. And I'm thinking to myself, it's like that song, Something That I Used to Know. So you have a mountain ahead of you to climb if you want to dive into that level of mathematics.
Yeah, and I see that. And oh, sorry, did I interrupt you again?
No, I just apologizing for smiling and reminiscing to myself right now.
No, that's
knowing
all right.
What kind of boat you're in.
And it's just one of those things I feel driven to do. Like I have to do it, and I enjoy it. Like there's so much joy, and even just this conversation wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been so involved and interested in this. So yeah, it's been a long, hard road, but I don't know if you, Karen, if you had anything you wanted to add before we kind of try to move forward on.
Well, when I hear you talking about the 120 cell, the 120 dodecahedrons and the two rings of 10 distinct 600 cell icosahedrons and the 20, 30 tetrahedronic tori with the Möbius strip and all that, it's starting to sound suspiciously like some extrapolation of Wolfram's physics. I mean, that just the way it works in my brain is Wolfram's little hyper graphs are building out into all of these structures, like creating the universe out of this. Well, he says all possible rules being chosen in all possible ways, which I was thinking the other day, I've been trying to write down my own thoughts, and, you know, 50 pages later, I still don't have even a beginning on it. But I was thinking about how when an artist is painting and each stroke is building up on the next stroke, and every time you put down a new stroke, you've changed the context of the painting. So then everything has to be recalculated based on each stroke. But if you were to imagine that somehow every one of those strokes in the painting was like one of Glenn's little, what do you call those, robo-dog? The different parts of a robo-dog, where each one has its own programming or its own instruction set inside of it. If all those strokes of the painting, if the universe were made of all these strokes of a painting over time building up so that each stroke has its own choice-making, not choice-making, but has its own instruction set moving around with the context continually changing, some of the strokes might go in a way that's not ultimately beautiful, and yet in Wolfram's language, the dividing out can always come back to the place where there's always a way to get back to where the creativity is going on. And so, yeah, I don't know how to explain it, but anyway, that's the picture I'm starting to get from your dodecahedron, icosahedron, tetrahedron. Right? It's this picture of the hypergraph building out a universe.
Well, I bet you could start with Wolfram and get to where you're at, Gabriel.
Yeah.
If you're up on the mathematics and drink
See, that's
enough coffee.
That's exactly my problem, is I'm trying to build this thing, hoping I'll eventually run into somebody with their model. And I see that in Wolfram as well, just the parallels, and so many others, like Watson, you mentioned his parallel of folding in and folding out, like that's built into the system that I've mapped. Mm-hmm. And
well,
so
have you read David Bohm's work?
No, I some of it, and I've watched some videos kind of explaining what he's worked on. Is there anything in particular that came to mind for you about what he's done?
Do I have the books in here? There's a couple of books that came out just recently that picked up some of his originally unpublished work that are some of his lectures that he did later in life that he didn't turn into a book, and somebody took those lectures and turned them into books. And one of them is on wholeness and the other one is on art. I can't think of the names of them right now. I have both books and I've been working through both of them. And he's always talking about this enfolding and unfolding, how things get folded up inside and then unfolded. And I've talked many times before about how I think the book of Genesis is talking about something like that, where the waters are being gathered up so that the dry land is revealed. There's this tension of pulling apart and, you know, and putting back together again. So something like that is being told to us, I think, in the scriptures as well.
I would agree with that. I've even with the Ten Commandments, as they lay out in order based on the specific sets of aspects, like that was one thing that happened that I wasn't looking for it. I didn't expect it, but then I realized, like having built my cycle, if you follow the five sensory aspects, starting with consciousness, you have an association with the first through fifth in order commandment. And then if you follow the cycle, starting with the body, I think it is, yes. It cycles through 6 through 10 in order. So you have those two separate groups of five, which pops up with those rings as well. And the commandments are cycling in order. And so the way I think of it is the law, the logos, the order, the rule set that was set at the beginning is evident in those 10 laws and plays out, at least as I see it, in the same process of cognition, where we move through creation in a certain way to update our system and align ourselves more perfectly with truth. If that makes sense.
Well, one thought to go back a little bit, when you're talking about the geometries involved, is that as soon as you get into geometries, you're talking topology, and then you can bring in algebraic relationships on the fields and stuff. So I think you're experiencing what always happens is you can talk geometry, but once you get sophisticated enough in your geometric thinking, you realize you're doing algebra now too. There's algebra of the geometric, the topology. And that is one of the most challenging areas in math, is algebraic topology, because it brings together multiple things and multiple tools. And at which point you just go, And
Yeah,
run away.
that's been my experience over the years trying to build this model is I will touch on and I will read through all of that complex, difficult stuff, and I'll get to a place where I don't understand and I kind of have to pull back. And then the path is almost laid out for me because there's only this one direction I can build because everything around me, it's almost like the elephant that you've mentioned with the philosophers. It's like they all have their vision of the elephant, and it can get like string theory, it can get incredibly complex and difficult to understand. But what if, like, God uses the foolish things to confound the wise? Like, I've clung to that scripture as someone trying to figure this stuff out, in a way that I can understand, and just kind of had to follow a very specific path. And I have found encouragement just running in, seeing my patterns as they emerge, start to run in and match the images that come out of what these incredible mathematicians are doing. It's like, okay, like this kind of fits here and that kind of fits there. And so it's like, that's what I'm kind of aiming at is like, okay, like eventually if I get the shape right, then these people will be able to explain it. But I got to get the shape right. So
Well, I think that's something they miss about the parable of the blind man and the elephant is that even though they all disagree, they're all still talking about something that's real, that they're all experiencing, and they're all just because they disagree doesn't mean that they're wrong. They all, in a sense, are right. And so that's where I when I see that happening as a physicist, my instinct is, okay, there's something more fundamental now that they're all grasping at. And then so that's what I would go to.
Yeah, that's
What is deeper? What could give rise to what I'm seeing that's more fundamental?
yeah, and that's why how I talk about it is tracing the shape on the floor, like all the way down at the bottom. And I guess in a delusionally optimistic sense, I'm hoping that I can kind of sneak up in that space in the middle between all of these ideas and then just come up with a little hub into which I can start to plug these things so that I can start to understand where they belong and how they connect and how this perspective is correct when you think of it this way and that perspective is correct when you think of it that way. And here's what comes in and here's what falls out as far as what's legitimate. And here's a simplification of these really complex concepts. So to make it more understandable and even make it more streamlined, it's kind of like I can't think of an exact example, but you can any system you could like Rube Goldberg your way to getting your teeth brushed with 3 dozen different mechanisms, but you can also just take the toothbrush in your hand and like it doesn't have to be all this extra implementation of tools to understand the process of toothbrushing. It can be much closer to you and much more simple. And so I don't know, that's not ex a perfect example, but that's kind of how I'm thinking of it. It's like I see how some of these things might be overcomplex, and this approach could be simplified if you understand more directly how those things connect.
Yeah,
So
your model could end up being over complex. You're trying to capture something you see, and so you build this model, but then maybe 5 years down the road, at the rate you're going, you'll go, oh, wait a second, I can undo this. Thought comes to mind, Penrose tiling. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it, but I wouldn't trust myself to explain it.
Yeah. So, they were reducing down the tiling, and then after playing with it on the floor, literally tiling, somebody realized, oh, I can get by with even simpler shapes and then still recreate the whole thing. So that's a fun thing to look up is Penrose tiling.
Yeah, no, I'll revisit that definitely.
Because people have made the Penrose tiles and then they play with them on the floor.
Yeah.
But
I'd like to go back to something you said at the beginning, Glenn, when you said you're starting to see this pattern being talked about by many different people, but with a slightly different shade to it. And I'm seeing that too. I'm starting to see as though we are all zeroing in on something, and it's happening across many different avenues. And I'd like to just share a video with you guys, a couple of
Okay.
minutes of Jordan Hall. I don't know if you saw the conversation that he had with Rafe Kelly. It's a really
No.
remarkable conversation, but I want to play 2 minutes of it for you because that pattern popped up and I thought, I've got to talk to this guy. I hadn't really been all that interested in talking to him before because it didn't seem like he was in my wheelhouse, but then I heard this 2 minutes and I thought, wow, this is, we're all coming to the same conclusion somehow. So let me share screen here. Wait a minute, I gotta. Share screen. But I don't know. I don't know if my sound is optimized here. So give me 1 more second. There it is, share sound. Okay. They keep changing the screen on this Zoom thing. It's driving me crazy. Can you all see Jordan Hall sitting here?
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I'm gonna run back to about here, maybe.
Interesting location to think about because you have the milieu, the context, which is remember in terms of identity, we're not yet separating out parts. We have the context, and it's
He's talking here about the zygote.
very difficult in particular to begin to sort of notice, is this molecule that eventually is going to become part of my heart, is it not me or is it pre-me? Like, how does this work, right? So the context, then we have the constraints or the designs, the characteristics that will ultimately select what is and what is not brought into this particular body in what way. And so we could say something like you were just describing, the field effect of the genetic and epigenetic environment, and probably a much larger set of characteristics than we currently give credit to, which produce a, and I would say, by the way, a transcendent field on top of the local context. And the conjunction between those two unfurls over time this process of embodiment. And so we begin to have a body, which we can begin to speak about, which has a continuously unfolding relationship to, which produce a, and I would say, by the way, a transcendent field on top of the local context. And the conjunction between those two unfurls over time this process of embodiment. And so we begin to have a body, which we can begin to speak about, which has a continuously unfolding relationship with its context, its milieu. And continuously is relating to it, interacting with it, dependent upon it, feeding back on it. And is continuously governed by something going on over here in the world of, let's say, the transcendent, or something that is, how do we say, qualitatively distinct than the causal structure of its milieu.
So you're basically pointing.
You see it?
Yeah, I mean, that's
It's the same exact picture, especially when, I mean, for me at least, with the picture of art, he says, you have the transcendent field on top of the local context. Okay, so you have the artist, the transcendent field on top of the context, which is the painting that you're working on. And the artist is not composed of just the artist, but the artist in relationship with the unknown. The conjunction between these two unfurls over time in this process of embodiment. You have a continuously unfolding relationship with its context. The relationship is always unfolding as the artist is making a stroke and then measuring, judging how it's pushing up against reality. is this getting closer to the vision or farther away from the vision? And then that has to go back through the transcendent access to recalibrate and then go back into the context again with the constraints of all the constraints that are related to the tools that the artist is using and the substrate that the artist is using. All of that is happening at the same time as each stroke is being made. And then it is continually relating to it, interacting with it, dependent upon it, feeding back on itself. So there's this process of iteration. And to me, that's this picture. It's how science works. It's how art works. It's how life works. And it's a process of measurement somehow, but not a measurement of quantification, but more a measurement of quality or of fittedness or rightness, always going back through that iterative process.
Can you do me a favor and kind of walk through that again?
No, I can't.
what you're getting at is, here is that transcendent context. It's the logos against which we're measuring, is these, the logos and the anti-logos. It's the balance that is set. And then you have this unfolding cycle that is written in the memory, which is this spiraling down of orbs, which is almost like, if you think of this as like a 3D printer spiraling out towards you, it's the unfolding and the moving out and processing and moving in and across and communicating and out and in and accessing that memory and making changes and adjusting the sensory aspects, adjusting the motivational aspects or motor aspects. So it's the sensing, the feeling, the thinking, and the expressing that's happening, and that is spiraling into itself, and you can see it more clearly in the colored version. And it's spiraling upward because those memories are being built, which are accessed to inform where you've been and to predict where you're going and to measure yourself against. So you have these pointed pedals, which are your calipers. Those dichotomies are your tools by which you measure yourself. So they're in between you and the logos, anti-logos structure of things, the environment. And so those calipers help you measure, and you make a change, you take an action, you make a choice. And what you have as a result is the fruit that is grown as a result of the seeds of decision that you've planted. So you measure against what is true, and you make a change, and then fruit is produced, either a good fruit or bad fruit. And I have those all labeled out. And so you've basically exactly described what I've done here. And I don't know how to kind of get that across to people, because I hear so many, like,
you just did. Yeah. I mean, that's,
did that capture it?
Yes. Because what I think what's happening here, that's, I think, very important, is that we're all coming to the same picture, and that because we're coming to the same picture, in order to communicate with each other about the picture we see, we have to simplify down enough that we can send this information over the wire. And what you just did there is the simplest way that I've ever heard you describe that. And it's exactly the same picture as painting a painting. It's exactly the same picture. And people think, oh, it's just one stroke at a time. No, there's so much complexity that goes into every single stroke. And the reason for the stroke and the outworking of the stroke and the final consequences of the stroke, all of that is tied up in making a painting. Yeah. And in my case, my difficulty is in being able to reveal the underlying complexity under what seems to be a very simple process. In your case, it's the matter of being able to take what in your mind is a very complicated process and simplify it down enough to pass it on to somebody else. And Glenn, of course, sees the whole world in mathematics. So he's got this
not always
huge structure in his head. No, because you also understand love and relationship and all of those things. So
yeah.
I'm coming up against not only a time crunch, but I am overloaded. So I'm wondering if we could kind of, because this is my second conversation in the last 4 hours. So I'm wondering if we could kind of wind it up a little bit, maybe, and each of you just say a little bit to kind of bring this to a conclusion. And we can maybe do this again sometime in the future. But I think we've had a very productive gathering here. So
I agree. Glenn, would you like to start?
Well, speaking as if we're a design engineer and you're the client, I'm kind of like, okay, let's reel you back in. And you know, I hope you will take this as a compliment, but you're definitely an Aspie. And
takes one to know one, too, right?
So I know where you're coming from. So I'm like, okay, let's slow down, pull back, and work on a little piece of this, because you're right, but we're going to build this thing. We need to pull it back. We need to focus on that 0 to 1 transition statement. And so I'd love to keep going with this.
Awesome. No,
I think we finally got, okay, I've got a handle, so we can work from here.
That sounds like wisdom to me, and I will definitely take that into account. Top priority. So, and I guess I just like to finish. I don't know if you got that email with those two images I sent you, Karen, but I just wanted to read, because I was thinking about the way you see things with the art, and I kind of, what is it, the properties, and what is the other thing that you talked about?
Elements and the principles.
Elements and the principles, that's what it was. And so I was thinking about those, and I kind of just, and this is very, just like, I laid them over what I was doing, just out of interest to see where they fell and how they fit in, because I wanted to be able to kind of see things as you're seeing things in the way that I see things. So that communication. And so I just wanted to read the little tiny narrative I built based on laying those things on top of what I've done. So I think I'd like to just finish with that. So the artist hears or makes a noise and becomes aware of gradation from which a focal point is established and given size. Brightness is adjusted using a variety of color. Amidst the flood, dominance emerges, taking shape. The variety of texture has a rhythm, each with a weight, which together form a balance. Variation finds its way to harmony, which is tested in repetition. Contrast adds value, and line creates unity by establishing boundary. The completed piece provides direction, or reveals direction, as the artist listens once again for new noise. And so that walks exactly through the cycle, associating each one of those things with a specific aspect of what I've done. So I just wanted to share that.
Okay, so your map starts in one particular place and then walks through. Okay.
Yes.
Now imagine you move over one slot and then you walk through it again. Then you move over one slot and you walk through it again. And at each slot, you walk through it, both going into the extreme on each of your items, and then walk through it again. And then you keep iterating as you move around. And every single time, that describes one stroke of the painting.
Yeah.
And only one stroke. And then all of the strokes together are your thing. In completion. So it's a pretty big picture. And for anyone to be able to put it together is like, I'm with Glenn, only 14 years and you got all this. So this has been terrific. And I apologize, I'm just wearing out. So I'm going to have to call it quits for right now, but this has been great. It's been fun to watch these two minds work together. And I appreciate you both so much and look forward to the next time.
So if you want to keep going and keep talking to me, and I'm up for another try. It's been
absolutely
nice.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful to meet you, and I think your perspective is exactly what I need at this stage, and I've really enjoyed your insight and again your wisdom. And likewise, Karen, thank you for hosting and just giving me an opportunity, seeing some guy making some crazy drawings and being like, hey, I'm going to talk to him. So thank you both.
And right. keep your eyes open. I think next week is when the Delbert Larson video on the ether is going to drop, and I'd love to get both of your perspectives on that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. Well,
talk to you soon.
All righty.
See y'all later.